Hello. On this week's program, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports on a new American opera composed by Nico Muhly with libretto by Stephen Karam. Dark Sisters is co-commissioned by the Opera Company of Philadelphia. Susan Lewis considers Anton Chekhov as Philadelphia's Lantern Theatre Company celebrates the great 19th century Russian writer's legacy. We speak with the influential Italian artist Michelangelo Pistoletto. The Philadelphia Museum of Art opens two exhibitions of his work on Tuesday. And Jane Pepper takes us to Arts Universe. The Wilkes-Barre Centre is a hub for artistic endeavour and arts education. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia is on fresh ground. It's commissioning a new opera, which is nothing out of the ordinary, but from cutting-edge talents, which is unusual. The team, whose work Dark Sisters will be heard at Philadelphia's Kimmel Center in June 2012, includes the hot 29-year-old composer Nico Muhly, a subject matter that's bound to raise eyebrows and sell tickets, the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints Church, who, unlike mainstream Mormons, practice polygamy. The opera also represents an unusual collaboration between New York's experimental music theater group and the also adventurous Gotham Chamber Opera. But the oddest part of all, as of this week's announcement of the project, the opera was already finished. Parts of it were performed Thursday at the Chelsea Art Museum by Metropolitan Opera soprano Jennifer Zetlin. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns was there and has this.
The new Nico Muhly opera, Dark Sisters, explores a culture that is, for many, unimaginable. A compound in a remote southwestern Utah mesa where a man might have 19 wives and 75 children? The opera begins after a government raid on the compound. The kids have been taken away by child welfare authorities. The husband, singular, is out trying to get them back. And the wives are beginning to question the meaning of their curious existence. The story has obvious dramatic potential, but why tell it through opera? Composer Muhly, whose work ranges from Anglican-style choral music to something resembling indie rock, suggests that opera is the only place where such complex emotional, legal, and moral issues can be portrayed. After all, he says, doesn't the marriage of Figaro have a large, sexually complicated household?
Opera is one of those things that you can express a great variety of things sort of simultaneously in a way that you can't in concert music, in a way that you can't in song, necessarily. I mean, you can in song, but opera sort of magnifies it. And most of my concert music sort of resists narrative just by nature of my interests or whatever. So opera is a chance for me to explore kind of storytelling, and it's just a slightly different way to organize musical thought.
But what about the obligatory operatic love duet? With as many as 19 wives, there could be many, too many for one opera. During the announcement reception on Thursday, I asked conductor Neil Gorin, founder of Gotham Chamber Opera, to explain that one.
There isn't a love duet. There's actually exactly the opposite. There's a duet between two of the wives who are fiercely competitive with each other. On the surface, they have the greatest affection for each other, and so the sparks start to fly in the course of the duet until they're both singing competing high notes.
The major spearhead behind the choice of subject matter was librettist Stephen Karam, an acclaimed off-Broadway playwright. After graduating from Brown University, he had an internship at a Shakespeare festival in Utah and noticed, at places like Kmart, women dressed in quasi-Victorian garb and speaking with a distinctive lilt. Investigating the lives of these fundamentalist women more closely, he discovered that some who had broken away from the sect had published their meticulously kept diaries. There were also anonymous blogs where they say what can't be said at home. He also developed a keen feeling for how this stark landscape could translate into music.
Southwest Utah is kind of like no place on earth. It really does feel like the promised land. You know, the sky is bigger and brighter at night than it is anywhere. And suddenly, although, you know, these women are on Dell computers and cell phones, their inner lives were so overflowing with sorrow and passion for their faith and confusion and the sort of the repression. So for me, I instantly was like, oh my God, these women are, they're basically singing already.
Are you listening to me?
Though Nico Muhly is only beginning to be known in mainstream music circles, getting a chamber opera out of him is a coup. He has written a grander piece for the Metropolitan Opera titled Two Boys, but Philadelphia will get Dark Sisters first. He now has two simultaneous discs released by the prestigious Decca label, one of the ballet titled I Drink the Air Before Me, and another featuring his choral music under the collective title A Good Understanding. Born in Vermont and educated at both Columbia and Juilliard, he already has a sizable output in a bewildering array of styles, gleefully borrowed from many different places.
I have no shame in influence. I like it. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's really the big lie about composition is that there's this, you have to constantly strive to be sort of original in, like, capital O. You know, and for me, I like being like, you know, actually I started with this thing that I got at the store, or I started with this thing that I completely stole from John Adams, or I completely stole from Ravel, or I don't see any problem with that.
His hallmark is juxtaposing unlikely musical gestures in the same piece.
You think about it the same way you do food, you know, where certain combinations don't seem to make sense, and yet they do. Sort of salted caramel or whatever, I don't know. It's like...
Such an unorthodox talent warrants a production formula that also cuts across the usual borders. Rarely do grand opera companies collaborate with smaller experimental organizations or vice versa. In this case, collaboration makes so much sense, you wonder why it hasn't happened more often. Opera Company of Philadelphia's executive director, David Devan, has a theory.
Egos. I mean, you know, it's really, is my baton bigger than your baton sort of thing. And a lot of times in the opera industry, people only want to work with people that are of similar scale and size in terms of stature and budget. And we think it's about the work. And we need to work with people that can bring something that we can't to the work. And that's why we're working with Gotham Chamber Opera Music Theater Group, because they're exactly what we are not.
Because the opera was virtually completed a month ago, Muhly is still orchestrating, the piece and its production have the luxury of time and will be honed something like a Broadway play. Workshops will give the creators a chance for second thoughts, trial performances in outlying areas prior to the November 2011 premiere in New York City will allow the creators to see what works best in front of audiences. It's always possible that the piece could be dickered to death, that the original intent will be lost. It's also possible that audiences will get an opera that's more crystallized right off the bat than what often unfolds at a world premiere. So it's possible that with Dark Sisters, the opera world might not only gain a smart new work, but a smart new method by which better operas can be made.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Dark Sisters will have its world premiere in New York City in November 2011 and be performed by the Opera Company of Philadelphia in June 2012.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The great 19th century Russian writer Anton Chekhov trained and worked as a physician, but became famous for his hundreds of short stories and plays that changed the way people thought about theater. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the artistry of Chekhov as the Lantern Theater stages Uncle Vanya and prepares for a festival celebrating the writer.
More than 100 years after Chekhov's death, his short stories are studied by students of literature and aspiring writers. His plays, particularly The Seagull, Uncle Vanya, Three Sisters, and The Cherry Orchard, have become pillars in the theatrical canon. Writing at a time when melodramas were the norm, Chekhov turned the action inward.
Don't listen to anyone who tells you, oh, people sit about drinking tea, nothing happens. Well, yeah, they're sitting drinking tea while their entire lives fall apart.
Lantern Theater Associate Artistic Director Casey McMillan is directing Uncle Vanya. She says Chekhov put commonplace worries and emotions center stage.
There are people trapped in situations for which they see no resolution, whether there is one or not. And they're filled with passion and drive and desire that you see frustrated. And that frustration is hilarious because we've all experienced it, because it is so human.
Chekhov experienced life in the waning years of Tsarist Russia. Patricia Dennison, senior lecturer in literature and theater at Columbia University, says the social order was shifting, the lines between classes blurring.
This used to be a world in which you had very rigid categories between those who were serving and those who were being served. And of course, as in so many countries, you had that rising middle class. And in one of these plays, he just talks about the cataclysmic change that is coming.
His father ran a grocery store. His grandfather had been a serf. Chekhov became a doctor and, says Dennison, an acute observer of human behavior.
He put at one point, he would like a writer to be as objective as a chemist, that it's not so much that you are judging your characters any more than a doctor would do that of his patients, but that you are very much an objective observer.
He worked his way through medical school and later supplemented his income as a doctor, in part by writing stories about Russian street life. His work was published first in newspapers, then in literary journals. He wrote short works of fiction and eventually began writing plays. Plays that would change the theater. Actor Peter Delorier plays Uncle Vanya in the Lantern Theater's production.
Before Chekhov, we were still largely in the Romantic period. Most of what you would see on stage were the melodramas of the 19th century. This was a real departure, this style of work.
Chekhov's plays were produced at the Moscow Art Theater by innovative director Konstantin Stanislavsky, who was exploring more realistic ways of acting.
The style of acting was becoming more what we moderns or postmoderns now recognize as naturalistic. And the writing demanded that kind of acting.
You can read descriptions of his performances of Chekhov's plays, and, you know, when Nanny comes out to call the chickens, there were chickens running around the stage, and that is a level of detail that's not right for the Lantern.
Uncle Vanya, completed in 1896, takes place on an estate in the Russian countryside. Sonya is a young woman who, with her grandmother and uncle, lives and works on the estate she inherited after her mother died. Uncle Vanya, who put aside his own dreams to manage the property for his sister, has continued to send money to Sonya's father, Professor Serebryakov, an aging scholar who is now married to the much younger Yelena, played in this production by Sarah Sanford.
And Serebryakov and his wife have run out of money, and they've come to live on the estate. So clearly these two worlds are clashing, and that's what we witness. And all of the intricate personal explosions.
Each character suffers angst about what might have been, and a sense of loss pervades the play.
There's the loss of Vanya's sister. That spot is filled in by Yelena, but poorly. There's the loss of money. There's a loss of stature. There's an economic shift happening. There's a political shift. And all these characters are feeling those shifts in different ways.
In this scene, Uncle Vanya has a moment in the garden with the young and beautiful Yelena.
Don't look at me like that.
How else should I look at you?
I don't like it.
I'm in love with you. For me, you are happiness, life, youth. I accept that the chances of you loving me are negligible, zero, in fact. But you don't have to give me anything back. I don't expect it. It's enough if you just let me go on looking at you, the sound of your voice.
Shh, they'll hear you.
You mustn't stop me. Don't push me away. To talk of love is all I need to scale the heights of human happiness.
Even though it's a torment to me.
Unrequited passion. Happiness beyond reach, and the way people can torment even those they love. With these kinds of subjects, the director Stanislavsky treated the plays as tragedies, says actor Peter Delorier, but Chekhov himself considered them comedies.
As do we. It's an ancient maxim that comedy is cruel. There's a sense of recognition in the audience of this pain, and there's laughter of shared pain, and there's laughter of surprise, and there's laughter of, oh my God, I'm glad that's not me this time.
The humor I've been finding in this begins to reveal itself the more you live in the world.
Sarah Sanford, who plays Yelena, says inhabiting a Chekhov character heightens her awareness of life's uncomfortable moments.
The more we've been on our feet doing runs, the more I realize there are opportunities for awkwardness, and you're saying something horrible, but meanwhile you're doing something terribly funny or just unrelated, and the juxtaposition of that is what is human.
It's comedy of human awkwardness, not unlike what's popular today, says director Casey McMillan. She describes TV shows like Arrested Development or The Office as a bit Chekhovian.
The awkwardness of two people in disconnection, of one of them not knowing what's really happening, or one of them not getting that they're being mocked, or how badly they want things that they can't have, that they're powerless, impotent to have, is funny. So it's painful, Chekhov is, but I certainly wouldn't call it hopeless.
Not hopeless because people go on, despite obstacles, frustrations, and dreams that never come to pass. Chekhov, the conscientious observer, wrote The Stuff of Life in all its messy details, where the ability to laugh at our own circumstances may be the greatest strength of all.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Lantern Theatre production of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya runs through November 21st at St. Stephen's Theatre in Center City, Philadelphia. A Chekhov festival next weekend includes the staging of one-act plays and short stories, as well as a panel discussion with scholars, including Columbia University's Patricia Dennison. Beginning Tuesday, the Philadelphia Museum of Art will stage two exhibitions by the highly influential Italian artist Michelangelo Pistoletto. Over the course of a more than 50-year-long career, he has worked in a variety of media, from paintings and sculptures to video and live performance, to invite audience participation in his art, a practice he began long before interactive art came into vogue. The larger show, From One to Many, is a survey of paintings and sculptures he created from 1956 to 1974. A student of graphic design with a background working in his father's art restoration business, Pistoletto in his late 20s began painting on reflective surfaces. This show includes a number of mirror paintings which reflect the viewer, making them part of the work. The smaller show, Città dell'Arte, which translated means City of Art or Fortress of Art, is a representation of parts of Pistoletto's creative space in his hometown of Biella, 50 miles northeast of Turin. It has as its centerpiece two large mirror tables, one in the shape of the Mediterranean, the other the Caribbean Sea. To launch these shows, Pistoletto will, this afternoon, reprise his famous 1967 performance piece, where he rolled a ball of pressed newspapers through the streets of Turin. When we met at the Philadelphia Museum of Art earlier this week, I asked Michelangelo Pistoletto about the idea behind this.
My idea, it was to bring sculpture outside of the museum, outside of the gallery, or the individual studio of art. And rolling in the street this paper, it was a way to bring art outside of the typical place for art, and to meet the people, to make art meeting the people, not only looking the work, but interacting with the work. And it was an experiment that worked, because everybody started to touch the sphere, to make it rolling, playing with. It was a great success, because everybody liked this idea, without explaining that was an art piece.
That was performance.
Yeah, the people felt to be part of it without any explanation. That, I think, it was very good.
And is that what you have in mind for Philadelphia as well?
Well, you know, I think for Philadelphia, there will be many explanations, but also it's the sphere was turning in the time, rolling in the time, and it arrives here. It's another one. It's done here with the newspaper of this place, and also the newspaper of these days, of the contemporary time. And I think it's good because it will take more people in around, it will make more manifestation around it. We go to the city hall to visit the mayor with it, and after the music will participate, and puppet theater people. And this is a way to make the work growing in a certain way, and interacting.
And everybody's welcome to touch it, to do what they want, to help in the performance?
Every time it's an experiment, because we don't know what will be the result. But this is good, because it's like the mirror. You never know what will arrive in the mirror, but you know that you have a mirror in front of the people, no?
Well, you mentioned mirrors, and a good portion of the new exhibition here at the Philadelphia Museum of Art is concerned with your mirror works, principally from the 1960s. Interesting to note that when there are a number of people in a piece, you always tell us how many are in there. Two, four people on a balcony, two people standing. And that immediately changes the minute the viewer stands in front of it, because the viewer becomes part of the painting. Yeah. Was that your intention?
Yeah, of course. This is the intention of the work that become my intention. Because finally, it's not me painting all the people that will participate to the exhibition that will be present in the show, but it is the work itself that is producing the effect. So I create an instrument that is able to bring the people inside of the work. And the people can be anybody, not just somebody, some special people. We don't have any special people. All the population can be part of the work of art.
This is a theme in your work. You always want the viewer to be involved. Is that the case in all of your work?
Yes. All my work is based on interaction, collaboration, bringing the art as a point of connection between virtuality and reality. You always go from reality to virtuality. Because also, after when I have seen my work made with mirrors, bringing the society inside of it, I decided to bring the society outside of the painting, but with the experience of the mirror painting. So it's a kind of an intellectual possession that we finally bring coming from painting to reality. It's like to have the Christian, they call baptism. You make an experience, an intellectual experience, and you bring it into life. Yeah? The moment that you are baptized, you are not like before. You enter the society.
Conceptually, you have some astonishing ideas. From a craft work point of view, you work in multiple media, paint, sculpture, performance. From the traditional craft point of view, how useful was it to you to have worked in your father's business, restoring other people's work?
Yeah, the restoration was very important as an experience for me when I started to work with my father when I was 14 years old. And I was able to touch with my hand the material that means the work of art. Not only looking, but understanding how it's done.
And are we talking about great works of art here or modern contemporary works?
No, antique art from Middle Age to Renaissance to 19th century. But finally, my mother wanted me to study advertising, graphic designer. And so that was very important for me because through the restoration, I was looking in the past. And through design, through the advertising, I was looking in the future. It is why the future and the past became two points very important in the present of my work.
How important is it, do you think, that artists generally have these great craft skills? Because a lot of the time you will have younger contemporary artists who don't have great brush skills, they can't sculpt, they are very good conceptual artists, but they don't have the craft work.
But I don't know if it is necessary. For me it has been very helpful, but I don't know if it is necessary for people that now use new technologies really to be craft.
It's the concept that counts.
I don't think it's really necessary today.
This exhibition focuses on the early part of your career. The most recent work in the exhibition is from more than 35 years ago. Why? Why have an exhibition of work that's not about you today?
There is a point of really concern with the present, that is the Città dell'Arte section. But Carlos Basualto, the curator, decided to make a very historical exhibition because I think it's very important to define what is already historical and what little by little become contemporary. I feel to be a piece of history already in this exhibition. But that doesn't take away the fact that I'm still alive. And many things happened after 64. I did so many things that if you have been showing all together, perhaps people will be a little bit
confused.
It's good to have one lesson after the other.
Michelangelo Pistoletto. Two exhibitions of his work, From One to Many, 1956 to 1974, and Città dell'Arte, open Tuesday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and run through January 16th. This afternoon, the artist will reprise his famous 1967 performance piece, Walking Sculpture, by rolling a ball of pressed newspapers through the streets of Philadelphia. It sets off from the Philadelphia Museum of Art steps at 1. The citizens of Wilkes-Barre, a 206-year-old town perched on the edge of the Susquehanna River, have endured disastrous flooding and job losses in mining and on the railroads. But as WRTI's Jane Pepper now reports, a 5-year-old art centre that offers opportunities for residents, from kids to vets, is helping to reinvigorate Wilkes-Barre's downtown.
An old stone building, once the First United Church, now home to Arts Universe, buzzes with activity nights and weekends. Kids come barreling in for piano and ballet classes and for orchestra rehearsals. Adults arrive for art, belly dancing, and yoga lessons. Last year, a drama group staged Conversations with My Dead Sister, written by Mark Dan Savage, a local playwright. Arts Universe has given new life to this structure, built in 1853.
It was a women's shelter for a while after the congregation had stopped coming.
Kathleen Godwin, executive director and founder of Arts Universe, was a longtime accountant who decided it was time to stop worrying about spreadsheets and return to her passion for the arts.
I was sitting in my office accounting one day, and I looked out the window and I thought, what would I rather be doing? And I thought maybe, oh, classical guitar class, because I play guitar and music. And no, then I thought maybe ballet. Then it hit me then at that second. Why isn't there a place where the normal dilettante can go and have whatever they want?
Godwin's roots were in the arts. As teenagers, she and her sisters sang and danced in TV commercials, on cruise ships, in USO shows in Philadelphia, and at New York's Waldorf Astoria in the Millikan Breakfast Show. After she married a theater professor at King's College, Wilkes-Barre, with 6 children from a former marriage, she became an accountant to help pay the family bills. Her business skills helped to make the dream of the Arts Center a reality.
So I started to seriously think about it and dream about it, and after about 6 years, I wrote the business plan.
She started small, offering classes and renting studio space to artists in an old mansion in downtown Wilkes-Barre. She was not prepared for her immediate success.
We were filled in 2 weeks. We had artists, about 20 artists there. Many of them are still here today. And they each had little rooms, and it was wonderful. We would do events, and little by little I figured it out.
After a couple of years, she expanded into the church, where in addition to renting spaces and offering classes, she now uses the 500-seat former sanctuary for drama productions. Godwin also brings art into the community. She started conventional music classes at the Veterans Administration with drums and ukuleles. Then she heard a story on the internet about a man who, after several heart attacks, gave up taking his medicine. With the money he saved on medication, he purchased harmonicas for 4th graders. This gave Godwin an idea for her students at the VA.
I was so inspired by the story, and he's been alive now 5 years, illness-free. So I bought harmonicas for the guys at the VA, thinking, why didn't I think of this before? So now, at least once a week, we play harmonica. And when you see someone who doesn't have that all the time or is not used to expressing themselves through, for instance, in this case, music, their eyes close. It's like sitting at a campfire.
Godwin is also helping to open young people's eyes to the possibility of creating music with everyday objects.
For instance, teach them how to play spoons. It's things they can take home with them. We'll work with homemade rain sticks. We play homemade glockenspiels, water bottles filled with water, yet varying levels in a scale.
Once the children have mastered their makeshift instruments, she helps them to combine their sounds.
And then you make an orchestra out of it, and it's thrilling for the children.
In the building's 22 studio spaces, Godwin has tenants, including piano and Suzuki violin teachers and yoga and Tai Chi instructors. The career of one of the visual artists has taken off in an unexpected direction. John Pekowski was a maintenance painter when he was asked by a local restaurant owner to paint pictures of Cadillacs and movie stars on the walls behind the bar. Shortly after, Pekowski got a call from a representative of Absolute Vodka asking him to submit concepts for a worldwide advertising campaign.
They accepted it, and next thing I knew, I was like in 36 international magazines within a 6-month period when they started running the ads, and it's been a whirlwind adventure ever since.
Meanwhile, Arts Universe founder Kathleen Godwin is always looking forward to her next adventure. She recently renewed her equity card and is auditioning for parts in New York City. And the future for Arts Universe? As we leave its current home, the former church, Godwin gazes across the street at the large, abandoned Masonic temple with a look in her eye that says, "What if?"
WRTI's Jane Pepper. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.